Good line of sight to the back, too. Not a bad spot, sir.
Good. Keep us posted.
Roger that, boss. Out.
Sergeant Johnston propped himself up on his elbows and watched the area through his 7x50 binoculars. The sun was warm. He'd have to get used to that. Johnston thought for a moment and reached for his canteen. Just then the car he'd ridden up wheeled forward and then dropped from sight. He heard the steel overhead wheels roll along the metal tubing and wondered what it was like to ride the damn thing. Probably right up there with skydiving, something he knew how to do, but didn't much care for, airborne ranger training or not. There was something nice about having your fucking feet on the fucking ground, and you couldn't shoot a rifle while falling through the air at 130 knots, could you? He directed his binoculars at a window. They were flat on the bottom, but curved into a point at the top, like in a real castle, and made of clear glass segments held together with leaded strips. Maybe hard to shoot through, he thought, though getting a shot at this angle would not be easy. No, if he got a shot, he'd have to take it on someone outside. That would be easy. He got behind the rifle scope and punched the laser rangefinder button, selecting the middle of the courtyard as his point of aim. Then he punched a few numbers into his calculator to allow for a vertical drop, came up with an adjusted range setting, and turned the elevation knob on the scope the right number of clicks. The direct line of sight was 389 meters. Nice and close if he had to take a shot.
"Yes, Minister," Dr. Bellow said.
He was sitting in a comfortable chair, Mike Dennis's, and staring at the wall. There was now a pair of photographs for him to stare at. They were unknowns because Tim Noonan didn't have them in his computer, and neither the French nor the Spanish police had turned either into a name with a history attached. Both had apartments a few miles away, and both were being thoroughly tossed now, and phone records checked as well, to see where they'd called.
"They want this Jackal fellow out, do they?" the French Minister of Justice asked.
"Along with some others, but he would seem to be their primary objective, yes."
"My government will not negotiate with these creatures," the minister insisted.
"Yes, sir, I understand that. Giving over the prisoners is generally not an option, but every situation is different, and I need to know what leeway, if any, you will give me as a negotiating position. That could include taking this Sanchez guy out of prison and bringing him here as, well, as bait for the criminals we have surrounded here."
"Do you recommend that?" the minister asked.
"I'm not sure yet. I haven't spoken with them, and until I do, I cannot get a feel for what they're all about. For the moment, I must assume that we are dealing with serious, dedicated people who are willing to kill hostages."
"Children?"
"Yes, Minister, we must consider that a real threat," the doctor told him. That generated a silence that lasted for a full 10 seconds by the wall clock Bellow was staring at.
"I must consider this. I will call you later."
"Thank you, sir." Bellow hung up the phone and looked up at Clark.
"So?"
"So they don't know what to do."
"Neither do I yet. Look, John, we're up against a number of unknowns here. We do not know much about the terrorists. No religious motivation. They're not Islamic fundamentalists. So I can't use religion or God or ethics against them. If they're ideological Marxists, they're going to be ruthless bastards. So far, they haven't been really communicative. If I can't talk to them, I've got Bupkis."
"Okay, so what's our play?"
"Put them in the dark, for starters."
Clark turned.
"Mr. Dennis?"
"Yes?"
"Can we cut the electricity to the castle?"
"Yes," the park engineer answered for his boss.
"Do it, Doc?" John asked Bellow, getting a nod.
"Okay, pull the plug now."
"Fair enough."
The engineer sat at a computer terminal and worked the mouse to select the power control program. In a few seconds, he isolated the castle and clicked the button to turn their electricity off.
"Let's see how long this takes," Bello said quietly.
It took 5 seconds. Dennis's phone rang.
"Yes?" the park manager said into the speakerphone.
"Why did you do that?"
"What do you mean?"
"You know what I mean. The lights went off."
Dr. Bello leaned over the speaker.
"I am Dr. Bello. Who am I talking to?"
"I am One. I am in control of World Park. Who are you?"
"My name is Paul Bello, and I have been asked to speak with you."
"Ah, you are the negotiator, then. Excellent. Turn the lights back on immediately."
"Before we do that," Bello said calmly, "I would like to know who you are."
"You have my name. I do not have yours."
"I told you that. I am One."
"You will call me Mr. One," the voice replied evenly, devoid of excitement or anger.
"Okay, Mr. One. If you insist, you can call me Paul."
"Turn the electricity back on, Paul."
"In return for which you will do what, Mr. One?"
"In return for which I will abstain from killing a child. For the moment," the voice added coldly.
"You do not sound like a barbarian, Mr. One, and the taking of a child's life is a barbaric act, and also one calculated to make your position more difficult, not less so. Paul, I have told you what I require. Do it immediately." And then the line went dead.
"Oh, shit," Bello breathed. "He knows the playbook."
"Bad?"
Bello nodded.
"Bad. He knows what we're going to try to do. On my side, I mean."
"Andre," Rene called from his desk, "select a child."
He'd already done that, and pointed to the little Dutch girl, Anna, in her wheelchair, wearing her special access button. Rene nodded his approval. So the other side had a physician talking to him. The name, Paul Bello, meant nothing to him, but the man would be a Spanish psychiatrist, probably one experienced or at least trained in negotiations. His job would be to weaken their resolve, ultimately to get them to surrender, and so condemn themselves to life in prison. Well, he'd have to see about that. Rene checked his watch and decided to wait 10 minutes. Malloy eased back on the cyclic control, flaring his helicopter for landing where the fuel truck was parked. There were 5 soldiers there, one of them waving orange plastic wands. In another few seconds, the Nighthawk touched down. Malloy killed the engines and watched the rotor slow as Sergeant Nance opened the side door and hopped out.
"Time for some crew rest?" Lieutenant Harrison asked over the intercom.
"Right," Malloy snorted, opening his door to climb down. He walked to what looked like an officer standing a few yards away, answering his salute when he got there to shake hands. Malloy had an urgent request to make.
"The trick will be to get close enough," Covington said.
"Yeah," Chavez nodded.
They'd circulated carefully to the other side of the castle now. They could hear the dive bomber ride running behind them. There was a good 40 meters of open ground all around the castle, doubtless planned by the main architect of the park to give the structure primacy of place. It did that, but it didn't give Ding and Peter much to work with. Both men took their time, examining everything from the little man-made streams to the bridges over them. They could see the windows into the command center where the terrorists were, and the line of sight was just too damned good, even before they considered the task of racing up the interior stairs. And those were probably covered by men with guns.
"They don't make it easy for us, do they?" Covington observed.
"Well, that's not their job, is it?"
"How's the recon going?" Clark asked over the encrypted radio circuit.
"Pretty well done, Mr. C," Chavez replied.
"Malloy in yet?"
"Just landed."
"Good, 'cause we're going to need him if we got to go in."
"Two groups, up and down," Covington added. "But we need something to tell us about that room." The Spanish officer, an army major, nodded instant agreement and waved to some people in the helicopter hangar. They trotted over, got their orders, and trotted back. With that done, Malloy headed to the hangar too. He needed a men's room. Sergeant Lance, he saw, was heading back with 2 thermos jugs. Good man, the Marine thought. He knew how important coffee was at a time like this.
That camera is dead. They shot it out, Dennis said. We have a tape of him doing it.
Show me, Noonan commanded.
The layout of the room was not unlike this one, Tim Noonan saw in the 50 seconds of tape they had. The children had been herded to the corner opposite the camera. Maybe they'd even stay there. It was not much, but it was something.
Anything else? Audio systems in the room, a microphone or something?
No, Dennis replied. We have phones for that.
Yeah.
The FBI agent nodded resignedly. I have to figure a way to spike it, then.
Just then the phone rang.
Yes, this is Paul, Bello said instantly.
Hello, Paul, this is One. The lights remain out. I told you to restore power. It has not been done. I tell you again, do it immediately.
Working on that, but the police here are fumbling around some. And there is no one from the park there to assist you?
I am not a fool, Paul. I say it one last time. Turn the electricity back on immediately.
Mr. One, we're working on it. Please be a little patient with us, okay?
Bello's face was sweating now. It started quite suddenly, and though he knew why, he hoped that he was wrong.
Andre, Rene said, doing so mistakenly before he killed the phone line. The former park security guard walked over to the corner.
Hello, Anna. I think it is time for you to go back to your mother.
Oh?
The child asked.
She had china blue eyes and light brown hair, nearly blonde, in fact, though her skin had the pale, delicate look of parchment. It was very sad.
Andre walked behind the chair, taking the handles in his hands and wheeling her to the door.
"Let's go outside, mon petit chou," he said as they went through the door.
The elevator outside had a default setting. Even without electricity, it could go down on battery power. Andre pushed the chair inside, flipped off the red emergency stop switch, and pressed the One button. The doors closed slowly, and the elevator went down. A minute later, the doors opened again. The castle had a wide walk-through corridor that allowed people to transit from one part of World Park to another, and a mosaic that covered the arching walls. There was also a pleasant westerly breeze, and the Frenchman wheeled Anna right into it.
"What's this?" Noonan asked, looking at one of the video monitors. "John, we got somebody coming out."
"Command, this is Rifle 2-1. I see a guy pushing a wheelchair with a kid in it, coming out the west side of the castle."
Johnston set his binoculars down and got on his rifle, centering the crosshairs on the man's temple, his finger lightly touching the set trigger.
"Rifle 2-1 is on target. On the guy, on target now."
"Weapons tight," was the reply from Clark. "I repeat, weapons are tight. Acknowledge."
"Roger, 6. Weapons tight."
Sergeant Johnston took his finger out of the trigger guard.
"What was happening here?"
"Bugger,"
Covington said.
They were only 40 meters away. He and Chavez had an easy direct line of sight. The little girl looked ill in addition to being scared. She was slumped to her left in the chair, trying to look up and back at the man pushing her. He was about 40, they both thought, a mustache but no beard, average normal in height, weight, and build, with dark eyes that displayed nothing. The park was so quiet now, so empty of people, that they could hear the scrape of the rubber tires on the stone courtyard.
"Where is Mama?"
Anna asked in English she'd learned in school.
You will see her in a moment, Nine promised. He wheeled her around the curving entrance to the castle. It circled around a statue, took a gentle upward and clockwise turn, then led down to the courtyard. He stopped the chair in the middle of the path. It was about 5 meters wide and evenly paved. Andre looked around. There had to be policemen out here, but he saw nothing moving at all, except for the cars on the dive bomber, which he didn't have to look at to see. The familiar noise was enough. It really was too bad. Nine reached into his belt, took out his pistol, and...
Gun! He's got a pistol out! Homer Johnston reported urgently. Oh, fuck, he's gonna...
The gun fired into Anna's back, driving straight through her heart. A gout of blood appeared on the flat child chest, and her head dropped forward. The man pushed the wheelchair just then, and it rolled down the curving path, caroming off the stone wall and making it all the way into the flat courtyard, where it finally stopped. Covington drew his Beretta and started to bring it up. It would not have been an easy shot, but he had 9 rounds in his pistol, and that was enough, but...
"Weapons tight!" the radio earpiece thundered. "Weapons tight! Do not fire!"
Clark ordered them.
"Fuck!"
Chavez rasped next to Peter Covington. "Yes," the Englishman agreed, "quite." He holstered his pistol, watching the man turn and walk back into the shelter of the stone castle.
"I'm on target, Rifle 2-1 is on target,"
Johnston's voice told them all.
"Do not fire. This is 6. Weapons are tight, goddammit."
"Fuck!"
Clark snarled in the command center. He slammed his fist on the table.
"Fuck!"
Then the phone rang.
"Yes," Bellow said, sitting next to the Rainbow Commander.
"You had your warning. Turn the electricity back on, or we will kill another," One said. Chapter 15 White Hats. "There was nothing we could have done, John."
"Not a thing," Bellow said, giving voice to words that the others didn't have the courage to say.
"Now what?" Clark asked.
"Now I guess we turn the electricity back on."
As they watched the TV monitors, 3 men raced to the child. 2 wore the tricornio of the Guardia Civil. The 3rd was Dr. Hector Weiler. Chavez and Covington watched the same thing from a closer perspective. Weiler wore a white lab coat, the global uniform for physicians, and his race to reach the child ended abruptly as he touched the warm but still body. The slump of his shoulders told the tale, even from 50 meters away. The bullet had gone straight through her heart. The doctor said something to the cops, and one of them wheeled the chair down and out of the courtyard, turning to go past the 2 Rainbow members.
"Hold it, Doc," Chavez called, walking over to look.
In this moment, Ding remembered that his own wife held a new life in her belly, even now probably moving and kicking, while Patsy was sitting in their living room, watching TV or reading a book. The little girl's face was at peace now, as though asleep, and he could not hold his hand back from touching her soft hair.
"What's the story, Doc?"
"She was quite ill, probably terminal. I will have a file on her back at my office. When these children come here, I get a summary of their condition should an emergency arise." The physician bit his lip and looked up. "She was probably dying, but not yet dead. Not yet completely without hope." Weiler was the son of a Spanish mother and a German father, who'd emigrated to Spain after the Second World War. He'd studied hard to become a physician and surgeon, and this act, this murder of a child, was the negation of all that. Someone had decided to make all his training and study worthless. He'd never known rage, quiet and sad though it was, but now he did.
"Will you kill them?"
Chavez looked up. There were no tears in his eyes. Perhaps they'd come later, Domingo Chavez thought, his hand still on the child's head. Her hair wasn't very long,
and he didn't know that it had grown back after her last chemotherapy protocol. He did know that she was supposed to be alive, and that in watching her death, he had failed to do that which he dedicated his life to doing.
"See," he told the doctor, "we will kill them. Peter?"
He waved at his colleague, and together they accompanied the others to the doctor's office. They walked over slowly. There was no reason to go fast now.
"That'll do," Malloy thought, surveying the still wet paint on the side of the Nighthawk. "Policia," the lettering said.
"Ready, Harrison?"
"Yes, sir."
"Sergeant Lance, time to move."
"Yes, sir."
The crew chief hopped in, buckled his safety belt, and watched the pilot go through the startup sequence.
"All clear aft," he said over the intercom, after leaning out to check.
"Tail rotor is clear, Colonel."
"Then I guess it's time to fly."
Malloy applied power and lifted the Nighthawk into the sky. Then he keyed his tactical radio.
"Rainbow, this is the Bear, over."
"Bear, this is Rainbow 6. Reading you 5x5, over."
"Bear's in the air, sir. Be there in 7 minutes."
"Roger, please orbit the area until we tell you otherwise."
"Roger that, sir."
"I'll notify when we commence the orbit. Out." There was no particular hurry. Malloy dipped the nose and headed into the gathering darkness. The sun was almost down now, and the park lights in the distance were all coming on.
"Who is this?" Chavez asked.
"Francisco de la Cruz," the man replied.
His leg was bandaged, and he looked to be in pain.
"Ah, yes, we saw you on the videotape," Covington said.
He saw the sword and shield in the corner and turned to nod his respect at the seated man. Peter lifted the spatha and hefted it briefly. At close range it would be formidable as hell, not the equal of his MP-10, but probably a very satisfying weapon for all that.
"A child? They kill a child?" de la Cruz asked.
Dr. Weiler was at his file cabinet.
"Anna Grote, age 10 and a half, he said, reading over the documents that had preceded the little one. "Metastatic osteosarcoma. Terminally ill. 6 weeks left, her doctor says here. Osteo, that is a bad one."
Against the wall, the two Spanish cops lifted the body from the chair and laid it tenderly on the examining table, then covered it with a sheet. One looked close to tears, blocked only by the cold rage that made his hands tremble.
"John must feel pretty shitty about now," Chavez said.
"He had to do it, Ding. It wasn't the right time to take action."
"I know that, Peter.
But how the fuck do we tell her that?" A pause.
"Doc, you have any coffee around here?"
"There." Weiler pointed.
Chavez walked to the urn and poured some into a styrofoam cup.
"Up and down? Sandwich 'em?"
Covington nodded.
"Yes, I think so."
Chavez emptied the cup and tossed it into a wastebasket.
"Okay, let's get set up."
They left the office without another word and made their way in the shadows back to the underground, thence to the alternate command center.
"Rifle 2-1. Anything happening?" Clark was asking when they walked in.
-6. Nothing except shadows on the windows. They haven't put a guy on the roof yet.
That's a little strange."
"They're pretty confident in their TV coverage," Noonan thought. He had the blueprints of the castle in front of him.
"Okay, we are assuming that our friends are all in here. But there's a dozen other rooms on 3 levels.
"This is Bear," a voice said over the speaker Noonan had set up. "I am orbiting now. What do I need to know? Over."
"Bear, this is 6, Clark replied. "The subjects are all in the castle. There's a command and control center on the 2nd floor. Best guess everybody's there right now. Also, be advised the subjects have killed a hostage."
"A little girl," John added.
In the helicopter, Malloy's head didn't move at the news.
Roger. Okay, Six, we will orbit and observe. Be advised we have all our deployment gear aboard. Over.
Roger that. Out. Clark took his hand off the transmit button. The men were quiet, but their looks were intense, Chavez saw. Too professional for an overt display. Nobody was playing with a personal weapon, or anything as Hollywood as that. Yet their faces were like stone, only their eyes moving back and forth over the diagrams, or flickering back and forth to the TV monitors. It must have been very hard on Homer Johnston, Ding thought. He'd been on the fucker when he shot the kid. Homer had kids, and he could have transported the subject into the next dimension as easily as blinking his eyes. But no, that would not have been smart, and they were paid to be smart. The men hadn't been ready for even an improvised assault, and anything that smacked of improvisation would only get more children killed. And that wasn't the mission either. Then a phone rang. Bello got it, hitting the speaker button. Yes, the doctor said. We regret the incident with the child, but she was soon to die anyway. Now, when will our friends be released?
Paris hasn't gotten back to us yet, Bello replied.
Then, I regret to say, there will be another incident shortly. Look, Mr. One, I cannot force Paris to do anything. We are talking, negotiating with government officials, and they take time to reach decisions. Governments never move fast, do they?
Then I will help them. Tell Paris that unless the aircraft bringing our friends is ready for us to board it in 1 hour, we will kill a hostage, and then another, every hour, until our demands are met, the voice said, entirely without emotional emphasis.
That is unreasonable. Listen to me. Even if they brought all of them out of their prisons now, it would take at least 2 hours to get them here. Your wishes cannot make an airplane fly faster, can they?
That generated a thoughtful pause.
Yes, that is true. Very well, we will commence the shooting of hostages in 3 hours from now. No, I will start the countdown on the hour. That gives you an additional 12 minutes. I will be generous. Do you understand? Yes, you say that you will kill another child at 2200 hours, and another one every hour after that.
Correct. Make sure that Paris understands.
And the line went dead. Well? Clark asked.
John, you don't need me here for this. It's pretty damn clear that they'll do it. They killed the first one to show us who's the boss. They plan to succeed, and they don't care what it takes for them to do so. The concession he just made may be the last one we're going to get.
What is that? Esteban asked. He walked to the window to see. Helicopter!
Oh?
Rene went there also. The windows were so small that he had to move the Basque aside.
Yes, I see the police have them.
Large one, he added with a shrug. This is not a surprise, but... Jose, get up to the roof with the radio and keep us informed. One of the other Basques nodded and headed for the fire stairwell. The elevator would have worked fine, but he didn't want to be inconvenienced by another power shut-off.
Command, Rifle 2-1, Johnston called a minute later.
Rifle 2-1, this is 6.
I got a guy on the castle roof. One man, armed with what looks like an Uzi. And he's got a brick, too. Just one. Nobody else is joining up at this time.
Roger that, Rifle 2-1.
This isn't the guy who whacked the kid, the sergeant added.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Rifle 3 has him, too. Just walked over to my side. He's circulating around.
Yeah, looking over the edge, looking down.
John?
It was Major Covington.
Yes, Peter?
We're not showing them enough.
What do you mean?
Give them something to look at. Policemen. An inner perimeter.
If they don't see something, they're going to wonder what's going on that they cannot see.
Good idea, Noonan said.
Clark liked it.
Colonel?
Yes, Nuncio replied.
He leaned over the table.
I propose two men here,
two more here,
here,
here.
Yes, sir, please make that happen right away.
Rene, Andre called from in front of a TV screen. He pointed. Look.
There were two Guardia cops moving slowly and trying to be covert as they approached up Strada España to a place 50 meters from the castle. Rene nodded and picked up his radio.
Three.
Yes, one.
Police approaching the castle. Keep an eye on them.
I will do that, one, Esteban promised.
Okay, they're using radios, Noonan said, checking his scanner. Citizen band walkie-talkies, regular commercial one, set on Channel 16. Pure vanilla.
No names? Just numbers? Chavez asked.
So far.
Our point of contact calls himself one, and this guy is three.
Okay, does that tell us anything?
Radio games, Dr. Bello said.
Right out of the playbook. They're trying to keep their identities secret from us, but that's also in the playbook.
The two photo ID pictures had long since been sent to France for identification, but both the police and intelligence agencies had come up dry.
Okay, will the French deal?
A shake of the head.
I don't think so.
The minister, when I told him about the Dutch girl, he just grunted and said Carlos stays in the jug no matter what. And he expects us to resolve the situation successfully. And if we can't, his country has a team of his own to send down. So we've got to have a plan in place and ready to go. By 2200.
Unless you want to see them kill another hostage, yes, Bello said. They're denying me my ability to guide their behavior. They know how the game is played.
Professionals?
Bello shrugged.
Might as well be. They know what I'm going to try, and if they know it ahead of time, then they know how to maneuver clear.
No way to mitigate their behavior? Clark asked, wanting it clear.
I can try, but probably not. The ideological ones are the ones who have a clear idea of what they want. Well, they're hard to reason with. They have no ethical base to play with, no morality in the usual sense, nothing I can use against them. No conscience.
Yeah, we saw that, I guess.
Okay.
John stood up straight and turned to look at his two team leaders.
You got 2 hours to plan it, and one more to set it up. We go at 2200 hours.
We need to know more about what's happening inside, Covington told Clark.
Noonan, what can you do?
The FBI agent looked down at the blueprints, then over at the TV monitors.
I need to change, he said, heading over to his equipment case and pulling out the green-on-green night gear. The best news he'd seen so far was that the castle windows made for two blind spots. Better yet, they could control the lights that bled energy into both of them. He walked over to the park engineer next.
Can you switch off these lights along here?
Sure. When?
When the guy on the roof is looking the other way.
And I need somebody to back me up, Noonan added.
I can do that, First Sergeant Vega said, stepping forward.
The children were whining. It had started 2 hours earlier and only gotten worse. They wanted food. Something adults would probably not have asked for, since adults would be far too frightened to eat. But children were different, somehow. They also needed to use the restroom quite a bit. And, fortunately, there were two bathrooms adjacent to the control room, and Renee's people didn't stop them from going. The restrooms had no windows or phones or anything to make escape or communication possible. And it wasn't worth the aggravation to have the children soiling their pants. The children didn't talk directly to any of his people, but the whining was real and growing.
Well-behaved kids, else it would be worse, Rene told himself with an ironic smile.
He looked at the wall clock.
Three, this is one.
Yes, one.
K-2.
came the reply.
What do you see?
8 policemen, 4 pairs watching us, but doing nothing but watching.
Good.
And he set the radio down.
Log that, Noonan said.
He'd checked the wall clock. It was about 15 minutes since the last radio conversation. He was in his night costume now, the 2-shade greens they'd used in Vienna. His Beretta 45 automatic, with suppressor, was in a special, large shoulder holster over his body armor, and he had a backpack slung over one shoulder.
Vega, ready to take a little walk?
You betcha, Oso replied, glad at last to be doing something on a deployment. As much as he liked being responsible for the team's heavy machine gun, he'd never gotten to use it, and, he thought, probably never would. The biggest man on the team, his hobby was pumping iron, and he had a chest about the dimensions of a half keg of beer. Vega followed Noonan out the door, then outside.
"Ladder?" the first sergeant asked.
"Tool and paint shop 50 yards from where we're going," I asked. "They have what we need."
"Fair enough," Oso replied.
It was a fast walk, dodging through a few open areas visible to the fixed cameras, and the shop they headed for had no sign on it at all. Noonan slipped the ground-bolted door and walked in. None of the doors, remarkably enough, were locked. Vega pulled a 30-foot extension ladder off its wall brackets.
"This ought to do."
"Yeah." They went outside. Movement would now be trickier.
Noonan took command.
"6 here.
Start doing the cameras, John."
In the command center, Clark pointed to the park engineer. There was danger here, but not much, they hoped. The castle command center, like this one, had only 8 TV monitors, which were hardwired into over 40 cameras. You could have the computer simply flip through them in an automatic sequence or select cameras for special use. With a mouse click, one camera was disabled. If the terrorists were using the automatic sequence, as seemed likely, they probably would not notice that one camera's take was missing during the flip-through. They had to get through the visual coverage of 2 of them, and the park engineer was ready to flip them off and on as needed. The moment a hand appeared in camera 23's field of view, the engineer flipped it off.
"Okay, 23 is off, Noonan."
"We're moving," Noonan said. The first walk took them 20 meters, and they stopped behind a concession stand.
"Okay, we're at the popcorn building."
The engineer flipped 23 back on, and then turned off 21.
21 is off," Clark reported next.
"Rifle 2-1, where's the guy on the roof?"
"West side. Just lit up a smoke, not looking down over the edge anymore.
Staying still at the moment," Sergeant Johnston reported.
"Noonan, you are clear to move."
"Moving now," the FBI agent replied. He and Vega double-timed it across the stone slabs, their rubber-soled boots keeping their steps quiet. At the side of the castle was a dirt strip about 2 meters wide, and some large boxwoods. Carefully, Noonan and Vega angled the ladder up, setting it behind a bush. Vega pulled the rope to extend the top portion, stopping it just under the window. Then he got between the ladder and the building, grabbed the treads and held them tight, pulling the ladder against the rough stone blocks.
"Watch your ass, Tim," Oso whispered.
"Always." Noonan went up quickly for the first 10 feet, then slowed to a vertical crawl.
"Patience," Tim told himself. "Plenty of time to do this."
It was the sort of lie that men tell themselves.
"Okay," Clark heard. "He's going up the ladder now. The roof guy is still on the opposite side, fat, dumb, and happy."
"Bear, this is 6, over," John said, getting another idea.
"Bear copies, 6.
"Play around a little on the west side, just to draw some attention, over."
"Roger that."
Malloy stopped his endless circling, leveled out, and then eased toward the castle. The Nighthawk was a relatively quiet aircraft for a helicopter, but the guy on the roof turned to watch closely, the colonel saw through his night-vision goggles. He stopped his approach at about 200 meters. He wanted to get their attention, not to spook them. The roof sentry's cigarette blazed brightly in the goggles. It moved to his lips, then away, then back, staying there.
"Say hello, sweetie," Malloy said over the intercom. "Jesus, if I was in a Night Stalker, I could spray your ass into the next time zone."
"You fly the Stalker? What's it like?"
"If she could cook, I'd fucking marry her. Sweetest chopper ever made," Malloy said, holding hover. "Six, Bear, I have the bastard's attention."
"Noonan, Six, we've frozen the roof sentry for you. He's on the opposite side from you."
"Good," Noonan didn't say. He took off his Kevlar helmet and edged his face to the window. It was made of irregular segments held in place by lead strips, just like in the castles of old. The glass wasn't as good as float plate, but it was transparent. "Okay." He reached into his backpack and pulled a fiber-optic cable with the same Cobra head arrangement he'd used in Bern.
"Noonan to command, you getting this?"
"That's affirmative."
It was the voice of David Peled. The picture he saw was distorted, but you quickly got used to that. It showed four adults, but more important, it showed a crowd of children sitting on the floor in the corner, close to two doors with labels. The toilets, Peled realized. That worked. That worked pretty well.
"Looks good, Timothy. Looks very good."
"Okay." Noonan glued the tiny instrument in place and headed down the ladder. His heart was racing faster than it ever did on the morning 3-mile run. At the bottom, he and Vega both hugged the wall. The cigarette flew off the roof, and the sentry got tired of looking at the chopper, Johnston saw. "Our friend's moving east on the castle roof. Noonan, he's coming your way." Malloy thought of maneuvering to draw the attention back, but that was too dangerous a play. He turned the helicopter sideways and continued his circling, but closer in, his eyes locked on the castle roof. There wasn't much else he could do except to draw his service pistol and fire, but at this range, it would be hard enough to hit the castle. And killing people wasn't his job, unfortunately, Malloy told himself. There were times when he found the idea rather appealing.
"The helicopter annoys me," the voice on the phone said.
"Pity," Dr. Bello replied, wondering what response it would get.
"But police do what police do."
"News from Paris?"
"Regrettably, not yet, but we hope to hear something soon. There is still time."
Bello's voice adopted a quiet intensity that he hoped would be taken for desperation.
"Time and tide wait for no man," one said, and hung up.
"What's that mean?" John asked.
"It means he's playing by the rules. He hasn't objected to the cops he can see on the TV either. He knows the things he has to put up with."
Bello sipped his coffee.
"He's very confident. He figures he's in a safe place, and he's holding the cards. And if he has to kill a few more kids, that's okay, because it'll get him what he wants."
"Killing children."
Clark shook his head. "I didn't think... Hell, I'm supposed to know better, right?"
"It's a very strong taboo. Maybe the strongest," Dr. Bello agreed. "The way they killed that little girl, though. There was no hesitation. Just like shooting a paper target."
"Ideological," the psychiatrist went on. "They've subordinated everything to their belief system. That makes them rational, but only within that system. Our friend, Mr. One, has chosen his objective, and he'll stick to it."
The remote TV system, the park engineer saw, was really something. The objective lens, now affixed to the castle window, was less than 2 millimeters across at its widest point, and even if noticed,
would be mistaken for a drop of paint or some flaw in the window glass. The quality of the image wasn't very good, but it showed where people were. And the more you looked at it, the more you understood what initially appeared to be a black-and-white photograph of clutter. He could count 6 adults now, and with a 7th atop the castle, that left only 3 unaccounted for. And were all the children in view? It was harder with them. All their shirts were the same color, and the red translated into a very neutral gray on the black-and-white picture. There was the one in a wheelchair, but the rest blended together in the out-of-focus image. The commandos, he could see, were worried about that.
"He's heading back west again," Johnston reported. "Okay, he's at the west side now."
"Let's go," Noonan told Vega.
"The ladder?"
They'd taken it down and laid it behind the bushes on its side.
"Leave it."
Noonan ran off in a crouch, reaching the concession structure in a few seconds.
"Noonan to command. Time to do the cameras again."
"It's off," the engineer told Clark.
"Camera 21 is down. Get moving, Tim."
Noonan popped Vega on the shoulder and ran another 30 meters.
"Okay, take down 23.
"Done," the park engineer said.
"Move," Clark commanded.
15 seconds later, they were in a safe position. Noonan leaned against a building wall and took a long breath.
"Thanks, Julio."
"Anytime, man," Vega replied. "Just so the camera gadget works."
"It will," the FBI agent promised.
And with that, they headed back to the underground command post. "Blow the windows." "Can we do that, Patty?" Chavez was asking when they got there. Connolly was wishing for a cigarette. He'd quit years before. It was too hard on the daily runs to indulge. But at times like this, it seemed to help the concentration.
6 windows, 3 or 4 minutes each."
"No, I think not, sir."
"I can give you 2, if we have the time."
"How sturdy are the windows?" Clark asked. "Dennis?"
"Metal frames set into the stone," the park manager said with a shrug.
"Wait." The engineer turned a page on the castle blueprints, then 2 more, and then a finger traced down the written portion on the right side. "Here's the specs. They're held in by grouting only. You should be able to kick them in, I think."
The "I think" part was not as reassuring as Ding would have preferred. But how strong could a window frame be with a 200-pound man swinging into it with 2 boots leading the way?
"What about flashbangs, Patty?"
"We can do that," Connolly answered. "It will not do the frames any good at all, sir."
"Okay." Chavez leaned over the plans. "You'll have time to blow 2 windows, this one and this one." He tapped the prints. "We'll use flashbangs on the other 4 and swing in a second later. Eddie here, me here, Louis here. George, how's the leg?"
"Marginal," Sergeant Tomlinson replied with painful honesty.
He'd have to kick through a window, swing in, drop to a concrete floor, then come up shooting. And the lives of children were at stake. No, he couldn't risk it, could he?
"Better somebody else, Ding."
"Oso, think you can do it?" Chavez asked.
"Oh, yeah," Vega replied, trying not to smile.
"You bet, Ding."
"Okay. Scotty here, and Mike take these 2.
What's the exact distance from the roof?"
That was on the blueprints.
16 meters exactly from the level of the roof, at another 70 centimeters to allow for the battlements.
"The ropes can do that easily," Eddie Price decided.
The plan was coming together. He and Ding would have as their primary mission getting between the kids and the bad guys, shooting as they went. Vega, Loisel, McTyler, and Pierce would be primarily tasked to killing the subjects in the castle's command room, but that would be finally decided only when they entered the room. Covington's Team 1 would race up the stairs from the underground to intercept any subjects who ran out, and to back up Team 2 if something went wrong on their assault.
Sergeant Major Price and Chavez looked over the blueprints again, measuring distances to be covered and the time in which to do it. It looked possible, even probable, that they could carry it off. Ding looked up at the others. Comments? Noonan turned to look at the picture from the fiber optic gear he'd installed.
They seem to be mainly at the control panels. Two guys keeping an eye on the children, but they're not worried about them.
Makes sense. They're just kids, not adults able to start real resistance.
But it only takes one of these bastards to turn and hose them, man.
Yeah, Ding nodded. There was no denying or avoiding that fact.
Well, we have to shoot fast, people.
Any way to string them out?
Bello thought about that. If I tell them the plane's on the way, well, that's a risk. If they think we're lying to them, well, they could start taking it out on the hostages. But the upside is, if they think it's about time to head for the airport, probably Mr. One will send a couple of his troops down to the underground. That's the most likely way for them to leave the area, I think. Then, if we can play some more with the surveillance cameras and get a guy in close...
Yeah, pop them right away, Clark said. Peter?
Get us within 20 meters and it's a piece of cake. Plus, we kill the lights right before we hit.
Disorient the bastards, Covington added.
There's emergency lights in the stairwells, Mike Dennis said. They click on when the power goes down.
Shit, there's two in the command center, too.
Where? Chavez asked.
The left. I mean the northeast corner and the southwest one. The regular kind, two lights, like car headlights. They run off a battery.
Okay. No NVGs when we go in, I guess. But we'll still kill the lights right before we hit, just to distract them.
Anything else? Peter? Ding asked. Major Covington nodded.
It ought to work.
Clark observed and listened, forced to let his principal subordinates do all the planning and talking, leaving him only able to comment if they made a mistake. And they hadn't done that. Most of all, he wanted to lift an MP-10 and go in with the shooters, but he couldn't do that. And inwardly he swore at the fact. Commanding just wasn't as satisfying as leading.
"We need medics standing by in case the bad guys get lucky," John said to Colonel Nuncio.
"We have paramedics outside the park now."
"Dr. Viler is pretty good," Mike Dennis said. "He's had trauma training. We insisted on that in case we have something bad happen here."
"Okay, we'll have him stand, too, when the time comes. Dr. Bello, tell Mr. One that the French have caved, and their friends will be here... What do you think?"
10:20 or so. If they agree to that, it's a concession, but the kind that will calm them down, should anyway.
"Make the call, Doc," John Clark ordered.
"Yes," Rene said.
"Sanchez is being released from La Sante prison in about 20 minutes. Six of the others, too, but there's a problem on the last three. I'm not sure what that is. They'll be taken to De Gaulle International Airport and flown here on an Air France Airbus 340. We think they'll be here by 20:40. Is that acceptable? How will we get you and the hostages to them for the flight out?" Bello asked.
"A bus, I think. You will bring the bus right to the castle. We will take 10 or so of the children with us and leave the rest here as a show of good faith on our part. Tell the police that we know how to move the children without giving them a chance to do something foolish, and any treachery will have severe consequences.
We do not want any more children harmed," Bello assured him.
"If you do as you are told, that will not be necessary. But understand," Rene went on firmly, "if you do anything foolish, then the courtyard will run red with blood. Do you understand that?"
"Yes, one. I understand," the voice replied.
Rene set the phone down and stood.
"My friends, Illich is coming. The French have granted our demands."
"He looks like a happy camper," Noonan said, eyes locked on the black and white picture.
The one who had to be Mr. One was standing now, walking toward another of the subjects, and they appeared to shake hands on the fuzzy picture.
They're not going to lie down and take a nap, Bello warned. If anything, they're going to be more alert now.
Yeah, I know, Chavez assured him.
But if we do our job right, it doesn't matter how alert they are.
Malloy headed back to the airfield for refueling, which took half an hour. While there, he heard what was going to happen in another hour. In the back of the Nighthawk, Sergeant Nance set up the ropes, set to 50 feet length exactly, and hooked them into eye-bolts on the chopper's floor. Like the pilots, Nance, too, had a pistol holstered on his left side. He never expected to use it, and was only a mediocre shot. But it made him feel like part of the team, and that was important to him. He supervised the refueling, capped the tank, and told Colonel Malloy the bird was ready. Malloy pulled up on the collective, brought the Nighthawk into the air, then pushed the cyclic forward to return to World Park. From this point on, their flight routine would be changing. On arriving over the park, the Nighthawk didn't circle. Instead, it flew directly over the castle every few minutes, then drew off into the distance, his anti-collision strobe lights flashing as he moved around the park grounds, seemingly at random, bored with the orbiting he'd done before.
"Okay, people, let's move," Chavez told his team. Those directly involved in the rescue operation headed out into the underground corridor, then out to where the Spanish army truck stood. They boarded it, and it drove off, looping around into the massive parking lot. Dieter Weber selected a sniper perch opposite Sergeant Johnston's position, on top of the flat roof of a theater building where kids viewed cartoons, only 120 meters from the castle's east side. Once there, he unrolled his foam mat, set up his rifle on the bipod, and started training his 10-power scope over the castle's windows.
"Rifle 2-2 in position," he reported to Clark.
"Very well. Report as necessary. Al," Clark said, looking up. Stanley looked grim.
"A sodding lot of guns and a lot of children."
"Yeah, I know. Anything else we could try?"
Stanley shook his head.
"It's a good plan. If we try outside, we give them too much maneuvering space, and they will feel safer in this castle building. No, Peter and Ding have a good plan, but there's no such bloody thing as a perfect one."
"Yeah," John said. "I want to be there, too. This command stuff sucks the big one."
Alistair Stanley grunted.
"Quite."
The parking lot lights all went off at once. The truck, also with lights out, stopped next to a light standard. Chavez and his team jumped out. 10 seconds later, the Nighthawk came in, touching down with the rotor still turning fast. The side doors opened, and the shooters clambered aboard and sat down on the floor. Sergeant Nance closed one door, then the other.
"All aboard, Colonel."
Without a word, Malloy pulled the collective and climbed back into the sky, mindful of the light standards, which could have wrecked the whole mission. It took only 4 seconds to clear them, and he banked the aircraft to head back toward the park.
"AC lights off," Malloy told Lieutenant Harrison.
"Lights off," the co-pilot confirmed.
"We ready?" Ding asked his men in the back.
"Goddamn right we are," Mike Pierce said back.
"Fucking murderers," he didn't add.
But every man on the bird was thinking that. Weapons were slung tight across their chests, and they had their zip-lining gloves on. 3 of the men were pulling them tight on their hands, a show of some tension on their part that went along with the grim faces.
"Where is the aircraft?" one asked.
"About 1 hour and 10 minutes out," Dr. Bello replied.
"When do you want your bus?"
"Exactly 40 minutes before the aircraft lands. It will then be refueled while we board it."
"Where are you going?" Bello asked next.
"We will tell the pilot when we get aboard."
"Okay, we have the bus coming now. It will be here in about 15 minutes. Where do you want it to come?"
Right to the castle, past the dive bomber ride.
Okay, I will tell them to do that, Bello promised.